much, and probabilities have to be mapped to probabilities, so it's just Wigner's theorem. But do people who think in the other interpretation also have something similar, or like
people who think in the Church of the Larger Hilbert space ought to derive all of this from this instead? And
yeah, but where does that come from?
This is thought of as the dynamical equation. This is thought of as kind of a postulate. I sort of agree with you that in the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, there ought to be a derivation of this equation. You can derive some aspects of quantum theory from a principle, from like a superposition principle. But you won't get full unitarity from that. I believe that's the missing step in the Church of the Larger Hilbert space program. But they tend to view this as just the unproblematic axiom, right? It's like in classical physics, fields have equations of motion. Those are postulates in some sense. This is the way they would view this too. But as I say, we will see towards the end of the course that there is a way, a sort of a way of deriving these axioms from the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so then we have to say, well, we know that quantum mechanics only predicts probabilities, so we have to say what those probabilities are. So when this observable is measured, if the system is initially assigned this state just before the measurement, then the outcome MJ is obtained with this probability. So you sandwich the projector between the state. Okay, so those should be standard familiar axioms. Let me see, what did I say anything? Okay. You may also be, something that I haven't included in the postulates is the projection postulate or the collapse of the wave function. Often we do use that, of course, but I don't view it as a postulate because there are many ways of implementing a measurement, some of which do collapse according to the projection postulate and some of which don't. So when we talk about the generalized formalism in the next couple of lectures, we'll talk about that in a bit more detail. Okay, so that's the way that you normally see things in undergraduate textbooks. Since we're mostly concerned with the structural features of quantum theory and not the specific physical interpretations of the observables, we will often do this. So if you have an observable which has the same structure of eigenspaces, so the same eigenprojectors, basically, then regardless of what the eigenvalues are, you're always going to get the same measurement probabilities for those, right? So it's, in some sense, just a relabeling of the outcomes of the measurement. Okay? So we're often just more interested in this set of projectors that corresponds to the eigenspace rather than the observable self-adjoint operator itself. So we'll often talk of a projector-valued measure, which is just a set of eigenprojectors, basically. A set of projectors which are orthogonal onto orthogonal eigenspaces, and they must sum to the identity because you want your eigenstates to span the whole space. Okay, so we can talk about assigning probabilities to just a projector-valued measure. And then the last axiom is how we deal with composite systems. So if I have a system AB, which is composed of two subsystems A, which has Hilbert space HA, and B with Hilbert space HB, then the state space of the joint system is the tensor product of the two state spaces. And we will see more details of this axiom later on. So, but that should be more or less familiar textbook quantum theory. So are there any questions about that before we move on? Okay, good. So I said that's operational quantum mechanics. So what I've presented is operational in the sense that all I've done is given you a recipe for predicting the outcomes of measurements. I haven't said anything about what does a state mean other than that, right? It's just a recipe for computing probabilities in some sense. So it's not committed to saying what states and observables mean beyond that. That's good because we don't agree on all that stuff, right? But this part we do agree on. However, there were still some undefined primitives in it. So the idea of a system. A system is a thing that gets assigned a Hilbert space. What's a physical system, right? When you go and do an experiment in the lab, you rely on your pre-existing theory and your experimental experience to know that, for example, the state of the state coming out of a laser can be thought of as a system in that case. If you wanted to go fully operational, and some people do, although I don't believe it's a wise thing to do, then you would have to have a formulation that looks something more like this. Right? So operational means describe things in terms of procedures that you can do in the lab, in the laboratory. So here we have like a picture of space-time, and within space-time, there are some variables, these red ones, which you can control. They would be things like the settings of knobs on measurement devices, or the directions that you're firing lasers in, or things like that, things that you can control in the lab. And then there'd be some other variables dotted around, which would be things that you observe, position of a pointer on a measurement device or something like that. Okay, and an operational theory would then just have to predict what the probabilities of all of these things that you want to observe are, given the things that you can control. So here there's no talk of things like systems, and you can, and we will be interested in this sort of picture a little bit later on. So I'm just sort of previewing that. It's more operational than the way I've explained things so far. Of course, as I argued last time, you never get fully operational, right? If I want to check these probabilistic predictions, I have to repeat this experiment multiple times, and then I have to have a way when I draw this kind of thing in two different regions of space-time of saying which variables correspond to the same thing, right? Again, I'm going to use my theory to judge when that's the case, right? So you never get fully operational. Okay, so that was just review of quantum theory. So now what I want to do is talk about the kinds of phenomena that people regard as problematic. And we're just going to give you a grab bag of these things. They're going to come up, at least some of them will come up again and again later on in the course as we look at different approaches to quantum theory. So the first one is quantum interference. Now, this is another quote from Feynman, which you may well have seen before. It's a quote where he's saying that the double slit experiment is essentially the only mystery of quantum mechanics. Right? So that's the way he presented things in the Feynman lectures on physics, and it's been an extremely influential on physics pedagogy. You probably saw the double slit experiment in your first undergraduate quantum mechanics course, and this is the reason why. However, as far as I'm concerned, the idea that this is the only mystery, or even really a very big mystery, as far as I'm concerned, is not really right. However, let me be charitable to Feynman again. This is 1950s Feynman. We saw last time that by the 1980s, Feynman had kind of revised his views. And in fact, in that paper where he introduced quantum computation, he also derived Bell's theorem without ever quoting John Bell, right? So he kind of rederived it for himself as an argument that quantum computers, well, as an argument that classical computers oughtn't to be able to efficiently simulate quantum ones. So towards the end of his life, he was reviving this kind of view, but it's still very influential, this idea that quantum interference is a big mystery. So we certainly will have to talk about it and try to explain it. Okay, so the way I'm going to approach this is in terms of Mach-Zehnder type interferometers rather than the usual double slit experiment. It's conceptually simpler in some ways, and in quantum foundations, we often like to do everything with Mach-Zehnder interferometry. Makes things into qubits, basically. So the basic idea here is I have two possible modes that a photon can be in, right? So here's some single photon source, and maybe I push a button, and then a single photon comes out along here, or I can have a photon coming in this mode. So I'm going to consider just a two-dimensional Hilbert space where the zero vector means there's a photon up here, and the one vector means there's a photon down here. Of course, you can have states where there are multiple photons. For today's purposes, I'm only ever going to consider single photon states, right? So I'm going to consider the state space that's spanned by these two. So essentially, we have a qubit. Either I have a photon up here or down here. So I'm always going to take path length through the interferometer to be the same, because, of course, when you have different path lengths, there's a phase difference due to the difference in path length, right? Due to the difference in number of wavelengths along the path. But if we keep those the same, then we don't have to worry about it. You only have to keep track of phase differences, which come due to inserting optical elements like beam splitters and so forth along the paths. Okay, so then we're going to have various optical elements, just linear optical elements that we're going to consider. So the first one is a beam splitter. So when I have a beam splitter, then I have two possible input ports, here and here, and each of those beams can either be transmitted or reflected. If I'm going to keep the same Hilbert space, then I have to keep track of which path I'm going to call the zero path and which one I'm going to call the one path. Okay, so I'm always going to give the transmitted beams the same label as the incident beam. So if this is incident beam zero, then I'm going to call this output beam zero, and similarly here. Okay. So reflection means going from zero to one, and transmission from zero to zero or one to one. Okay, so the action of a beam splitter on this space is going to be given by a 2x2 unitary matrix. It has to be unitary, it's a quantum dynamics. And you can write it like this. How you write it depends, in principle, on exactly how the beam splitter is made, but this is at least one way of doing it. So you have a coefficient of transmission, which tells you that basically the amplitude from 0 to 0 and the amplitude from 1 to 1, and a coefficient of reflection, and those are complex numbers in general. So the transmittivity and the reflectivity are the mod squares of those things, and those tell you basically if I was incident in beam 0, what would be the probability of detecting the photon on beam output beam 0. Right, so that's the transmittivity and the reflectivity of the beam splitter. And unitarity of this matrix implies that those sum to 1. Okay, so when we're talking about a 50-50 beam splitter, which means that there's an equal probability of an incident photon here going up here or going along here, then we usually write it like this. That would be a 50-50 beam splitter, and we're going to use those most of the time. Okay, and any questions about that? then mirrors. You have to remember that when something is reflected off a mirror, it gets a phase shift, a pi phase shift. This basically, if you think about it, probably a lot of people can't remember the reason in electromagnetism why this happens. It's probably been a long time. But remember, when something is reflected, if you have a region of higher optical density and a region of lower optical density, then when you're reflected at the boundary, you get a pi phase shift. So that's going to happen in quantum mechanics as well. So basically, if I put a mirror in the path of the zero beam, then I need to apply a matrix, which is going to give a phase shift of pi, or of minus 1, on the zero beam, and similarly for the one beam. Because I'm always going to make the total path lengths the same, you don't need to keep track of more than just that phase shift. Phase shifters. You can induce any relative phase difference you like on the two beams. There's various ways of doing that. One is you could violate the rule that I just said and make the path lengths different. But another way of doing it is to just, if you were to insert a block of refractive material here, then the wavelength of light would be reduced within that material. And so the number of cycles that the two beams go through would be different. And by altering the properties, the refractive index, or the length of that block of material, you can, in principle, induce any phase difference between the two paths you like. So this, I'm going to denote a phase shifter like this. Okay. And then finally, we have detectors. So if I place a detector on the zero beam, then the probability of detecting it there will be the mod squared of psi with the zero vector. And similarly, if I put a detector on the one, beam here. So those are just that's just the usual quantum mechanical probability rule. Okay. So now, if the measurement is implemented in a particularly careful way that doesn't destroy the system and gives us the projection postulate, then after detection, the state would be updated in this way. So if you find that it's in path zero, you'll get updated, you'll collapse to the zero state, and if it's found in path one, you'll get updated to the one state. So with photons, that's actually very hard to do in practice. Most photodetectors absorb the photon, but we can at least consider in principle, and with great difficulty, construct detectors that actually work like this. Yeah.
Why do you call this non-destructive? It's completely
destructive. It's non-destructive in the sense that it doesn't completely throw away the, most photodetectors will just completely absorb the photon, right? It's non-destructive in the sense that you get updated to the eigenstate that you found. Okay. All right, so those are all basically the linear optical elements that you can have in a interferometer. So now here's the general Mach-Zehnder interferometer, and you will do some exercises on this in the tutorial. But the basic idea here is that we have a setup like this, where there are two possible paths through the interferometer, this one or this one, and they have the same path lengths. And in general, so that you have two beam splitters, you have the mirrors to make sure that the two beams converge. You can put a phase shift on one of the paths if you like, and then you detect at the output of these two beam splitters. So in general, a Mach-Zehnder interferometer has 50-50 beam splitters here and here, and an arbitrary phase shift. And this, you know, in classical optics, you would use this kind of setup to detect what's the phase difference between these two paths. So just before the detection, this will be your state, so the state over here. So you start inputting on the zero, you have to apply the 50-50 beam splitter, then you have the two phases from the mirrors, you have an arbitrary phase shift on the one path here, and then you have a beam splitter again. And then for this state, you would look at the probability of getting 0 and 1 at these detectors. So you'll do that calculation if you have forgotten how it works. But what you find is that the probability of detecting on the 0 output is just the sine squared of this phase difference divided by 2, and this one's the cosine squared. So in particular, if you have no phase shift here, if this phase shift is 0, then the photon will always be detected on path one. And the reason why it's always detected on path one is that the two beams here, that input here, they constructively interfere on path one, and they destructively interfere on path zero. Okay. So this is basically Feynman's interference paradox. This is roughly what he said about this. So in classical physics, if this were classical physics, you could have particles or you could have waves. They're mutually exclusive possibilities. The fact that we see interference at the second beam splitter, after the second beam splitter, indicates that the photon is behaving like a wave. But the fact that only one detector or the other clicks, you only see the photon at one place or another, indicates that it's behaving like a particle. Right, so if this really were classical optics, then these numbers here would be proportional to the intensities of the detectors. You would see, in general, some intensity at both detectors. Here, you only see it at one or the other. So the particles, so the photon is behaving like a sort of discrete particle-like object. Okay, so if it's a particle, then classically you'd expect that a particle either travels all the way along one path or all the way along the other path. It either goes along path 0 or it goes along path 1. So it's either going to go this way or it's going to go this way. So what happens if we try to check? Well, let's put detectors, let's put non-destructive detectors along these two paths here. Then you can do the calculation again. So now your state just before these detectors would just have the first beam splitter and the two mirrors. So that's going to be this state. It's an equal superposition of being in both paths. And that means that you're going to get a click at either of these two detectors with 50-50 probabilities. Equal probabilities, either of them will click. So afterwards, if you find this one clicks, then you will update the state to 0. If this one clicks, then you'll update the state to 1. Okay, so with 50-50 probability, you'll either be in this state or that state. Okay, so then you have to apply the final beam splitter, and that will map this 0 state to an equal position, superposition of 0 and 1, and it will map this 1 state to an equal superposition of 0 and 1. So regardless of which of those two cases happen, afterwards, either of these two detectors will click with 50-50 probability. Okay, so that's destroyed the interference effect. Previously, everything came out here, and now we have 50-50 probabilities. So attempting to check whether the photon really traveled along one path or the other destroys the interference, completely changing the experiment. Okay, so what's the traditional resolution of this? The traditional idea is that while we have this idea of wave-particle duality, an example of Bohr's complementarity notion. So we say that a photon will either behave as a particle or like a wave, depending on how the experiment is set up. Okay, so if you set up an experiment to detect which path the particle goes along, then you'll see particle paths. Maybe you won't see interference. It'll behave like a particle. On the other hand, if you set up an experiment which can detect interference, then you necessarily cannot say which path the photon travels along. Right? In order to have the interference, you necessarily need to not have detected the photon path. So according to sort of orthodox quantum mechanics, the question of which path a photon travels along during an interference experiment has no meaning. Right, so in this setup without the detectors, where is it? And I don't have the detectors. There's just no meaning we can give to the question of which path the photon went along. I just noted here that sometimes people say things like the photon travels along both paths or neither path, but has no meaning is closer to the Copenhagen interpretation or even textbook interpretation of quantum mechanics actually says. okay, so that's the idea, right? We can't say that the photon is a wave, we can't say that it's a particle, and so sort of the conclusion of it is you can't really say it's anything. We can't really say anything about it. So this isn't really all that mysterious as far as I'm concerned. So there are several assumptions that go into this argument, which are kind of, why would you assume that? So for example, we assume that photons have to behave either like waves or particles, right? It's one or the other. That's like it is in classical physics. You know, that's the way that Feynman does the analysis. Why can't we have something that behaves like both at the same time, perhaps both a wave and a particle at the same time? That's what happens in de Broglie-Bohm theory, for instance. Or why not something else entirely? Why do the properties of the system have to be these two classical categories that we're familiar with? What's going through the interferometer? Is it a wave or is it a particle? Why not something else, right? The other thing is that this analysis is also heavily operational, right? Because it assumes that it being meaningful to talk about particle paths is synonymous with being able to detect those particle paths. Okay. Okay, so if you can't measure something without completely screwing up the experiment, then it says that that thing doesn't exist. That's a very operational type of idea. In a realist account, you could say, well, maybe the photon has a trajectory that's either just unmeasurable, right? In realist accounts, we can posit things that are unmeasurable so long as they play some kind of explanatory role in the theory. Or it's not measurable without disturbing some other property that's responsible for the interference, right? So it may be that, you know, all the time there are definite trajectories, but somehow whenever you look at the trajectory, it messes up some other property of the system. So as far, and you know, we'll see some accounts like this later on. So in my view, interference is rather weak evidence for quantum weirdness compared to stronger things that we'll talk about, such as, for example, Bell's theorem. Okay, but that's the basic setup. Are there any questions about that? Yeah.
When we put a detector on one of the paths, it still interferes.
Very good.
I mean, it still does not interfere.
Right, exactly.
So
that's what's coming next, okay. By the way. So maybe I'll hold that until the next section. There's this thing called the Elitzer-Weidman bomb test. It's basically a much more, just a dramatic rendering of the idea of putting a detector just on one path. So here's the way it goes. So let's suppose we consider a bomb that's extremely sensitive to electromagnetic radiation. So as soon as even a tiny bit of electromagnetic radiation hits it, it's detected at the bomb fuse, it's going to completely blow up. The question is, can we detect whether we have a good bomb or a dud, which won't explode or do anything, without also blowing yourself up? So classically, you'd say, well, no, there's no way of doing that. I have to shine some kind of electromagnetic radiation on it to test whether it's a good or a dud. And then if it's good, I'm going to get blown up. Quantum mechanically, you can use quantum interference to do this. So it is basically just the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. You're going to put the bomb on one path with the fuse intersecting the photon here. And it works just like having a detector on one of the paths and not both. So first of all, if the bomb is a dud, then we're going to assume that it does absolutely nothing, right? It just acts like nothing. So you'll just get the usual Mach-Zehnder interferometer probabilities. The photon will therefore always come out on path one. If a bomb is good, then it's going to act as a detector here. Okay. So if the whole experimental apparatus completely blows up, then it's because the photon was detected here. Right, so the photon was on path one. However, if the bomb is good and there's no detection here, it means that you know that the photon went along this path. Okay. So, however, if you know that the photon went along this path, if you've effectively detected that it's up on this path, then your state will have collapsed to zero and you'll get 50-50 probabilities here. So there will be some... there'll be a 50% probability of detecting the photon there. So if you detect the photon there, then you know that the bomb must be good, but it didn't blow up. Right? Because if there was no bomb there, no good bomb there, then you'd always get the photon coming out here. So the conclusion is, if you see a click in detector zero, then you know that the bomb is good and that the photon didn't touch the bomb. And that will happen with probability a half if you have a good bomb here. Right?
But could someone say that, like people that think that maybe the photon goes on both paths? Like if the bomb explodes, maybe it could be because part of the photon touches and the other part is still going. I don't know.
Well, we're just assuming here that the bomb acts like a conventional quantum mechanical detector.
What I was going to ask is that if the photon goes, if we say can make the sentence that the photon goes through the path zero, but because the bomb still collapses it, which is non-local.
Well, whether it's local or non-local is something to be discussed. So that's exactly what we're going to talk about.
Because the photon will also destroy the other, the detector will also destroy the interference from the
Yes. So before I get to that, let me note that you can actually make the probability that the bomb gets detected arbitrarily close to one, just by using a more sophisticated interferometer setup. So we don't have to risk it getting blown up with probability a half in order to do this. You can make that arbitrarily low. That you'll see on the tutorial. Now, it's sometimes claimed that this bomb test is evidence for non-locality, right? So what you could say is that you know for sure that the photon was nowhere near the bomb at all. But the presence of the bomb still influences somehow what happens to it. The photon didn't go anywhere near it. So there's a lot of assumptions going on here. One is that you're assuming that if the photon goes along path zero, there's a photon there, then there's literally nothing that goes along path one, nothing that could influence the later experimental result that could somehow mediate the influence. This is simply not true in some interpretations, right? So in the Breuer-Bohm theory, for instance, the photon may go along one path, but the wave function goes along both paths, so it can mediate the influence. There are also other types of interpretation in which that happens. Quantum field theory should make you skeptical of this kind of claim, right? The quantum vacuum, whatever it is, having no photons, the quantum vacuum has some kind of substructure, we know that, right? So I will at least show you a model which makes use of this kind of idea when we get onto about lecture six, I think. So I don't think this is evidence for non-locality. It's just another wrinkle on interference, as far as I'm concerned. But again, it's something that we need to at least explain. Are there any other questions about that? Okay, right, wow, I'm going to be low on time again. Let's see. Okay. Before I talk about the other things, it's helpful to be very precise about what is what I'm going to call the orthodox interpretation of quantum theory. So the orthodox interpretation of quantum theory is what you normally find in textbooks on quantum theory, probably most of the textbooks that you've read. And it's usually called the Copenhagen interpretation in those textbooks. However, it bears absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to real Copenhagen, like the ideas of Bohr and Heisenberg and people like that. But this is usually used as a sort of stepping off point, right? We have the orthodox interpretation and we state the problems with quantum mechanics as problems with this interpretation. Okay, so it's useful to know at least what that is. So this orthodox interpretation leads to what's called the measurement problem. Any interpretation of quantum theory worth its salt has solved that already, right? So we can't say that the measurement problem is the biggest problem with quantum theory, but I gave you my three-point definition of what the problem was last lecture. That still stands. Okay, so the orthodox interpretation is a realist interpretation. You may be surprised by that, but it assigns properties to quantum systems, so that's realist. It's very straightforwardly and obviously wrong. Okay, so here's what it is. So it says physical systems have objective properties. This is often left implicit, but it does say this. This makes it a realist interpretation. And it says that the possible properties of a system are its observables, its observables are potential properties that a system can have. Possible values that those properties can have are the eigenvalues. Okay, so the properties of a system are some subset of its observables, and the values are possible eigenvalues. So how do we tell which observables are properties? Then we use this thing called the eigenvalue-eigenstate link. Usually in the philosophy literature, it's called this. You see it less in the physics literature. And that's this following statement. So when the system, the state of the system, is an eigenstate of an observable with a particular eigenvalue, then that observable is one of the properties of the system, and it takes value n. Okay, that's what we mean. And further, there are no other objective physical properties other than these. So you've probably seen something like that in the textbook accounts of quantum theory. So an equivalent thing that you could say is that the quantum state up to a global phase is an objective property of an individual quantum system, and the only, and in fact the only objective property of the system. And when I say the quantum state is an objective property, I mean individual is key here, right? Because I'm not giving something like an ensemble interpretation where the quantum state corresponds to an ensemble of multiple systems. I really mean an intrinsic property of an individual system. Why? Well, by the eigenvalue-eigenstate link, the projector onto psi is one of the properties of the system. It's an eigenstate of that with eigenvalue 1. And in fact, this is the only quantum state which is an eigenstate of this with eigenvalue 1. So this uniquely, the fact that this is a property of the system uniquely determines psi. So psi is, you can think of as equivalent to specifying that property. However, all of the other objective physical properties are uniquely determined by psi. If you know psi, you know exactly which observables are eigenvalues. So in some sense, in this interpretation, this psi is something like the phase space point in classical physics, right? All objective properties of the system can be calculated from it. Okay, so it's sort of equivalent to say that in this interpretation, psi and only psi is the description of what exists in reality. Let me give you some terminology to help with this. So we call a theory in which the quantum state is an objective physical property, in the sense I've just talked about, psi-ontic. Remember, ontology is the study of what exists. The orthodox interpretation is a subspecies of psi-ontic interpretation. It's a psi-complete interpretation. So this is a theory that's both psi-ontic, psi exists, and which is, in fact, the only objective property. Okay, because we could imagine that in addition to psi, there's other variables like particle trajectories. Right? That would be psi-ontic, but not psi-complete. In contrast to those two, there's the idea of psi-epistemic, which is a theory in which the quantum state isn't an intrinsic property of an individual system. It has a similar status to a probability distribution. You might call it epistemic, which means referring to knowledge, if you like the interpretation of probability, which says probability is about our lack of knowledge. Right? But depending on what you think about probabilities, you might call this different things. So if you like frequentist probability, you might call it a statistical state or an ensemble state. But as far as this distinction is concerned, they all mean the same thing. Like what I mean by this is just quantum state has a similar status to a probability distribution, something like, you know, the probability distributions you get in statistical mechanics. Okay, so the orthodox interpretation is an example of this type of interpretation. Psi and only psi exists.
But thinking of probabilities as lack of knowledge is just essentially realistic.
Well, it depends. I mean, we'll go into this in more detail in later lectures, but depends what it's knowledge about, right? So if you're a realist, you would say knowledge about the underlying state of reality. If you're anti-realist, you'll say it's just knowledge about potential measurement outcomes, right? You can give that both a realist or an anti-realist reading. Because knowledge about what is the...
So interference here, for example, quantum interference is just a byproduct of the fact that we don't know everything about our system.
Not exactly. I mean, obviously, classical probability distributions don't exhibit interference, right? So there has to be something more to a view like this. But we will see in later lectures how you can construct models of interference that are psi epistemic in this sense. I don't want to go into it too much detail here. This was just to lay some terminology which is going to come up again in the future and to at least classify what this orthodox interpretation is.
So what exactly do you mean by it has a similar status to a probability distribution?
I mean that if you knew the exact state of reality, that would not determine.
What does that mean?
Again, it's probably better to delay these questions until I introduce the ontological models framework next week, because then I will make precise exactly, I'll make mathematically precise what these distinctions mean.
Okay.
Okay, so back to the orthodox interpretation. Since we're running out of time, I'm not going to read out this whole quote. You're probably familiar with the idea of Schrodinger's cat. So the idea is, if the dynamics of the world is unitary, you can take a microscopic system, which is in a superposition of two states, interact it with larger and larger systems. The unitary dynamics is linear, so you can, from a microscopic superposition, such as whether an atom has decayed or not decayed, generate a superposition of two macroscopically distinct states, like whether a cat is alive or dead. Okay. So let's use a more relevant example, right? So if I make the output of my fake news algorithm depend on a qubit that's in the superposition of 0 and 1, then I could potentially create this kind of superposition state. Those are clearly macroscopically distinct, right? The news looks very different in these two branches here. So if we believe the orthodox interpretation, then this kind of state is physically distinct from either of these two. This state has different objective physical properties, right? Here, the projector onto this state is very different from the projector onto either of these two states. But we've never seen something like this, right? We've never really had any direct experience of something which is a superposition of macroscopically distinct states. So, in the sense that I was talking about last time, it doesn't save the phenomena. If we say that you can generate a superposition like this, but we've never experienced that in reality, in our experience, then there's something wrong. Then we have something to explain. So related to that is the measurement problem. Now, I have a pet peeve here, which is a lot of people say, the measurement problem and Schrodinger's cat, they're the same thing. They're the same thing, provided you assume that measurement means interaction of a microscopic system with a macroscopic measuring device that ends up in two macroscopically distinct states. If that's your definition of measurement, it's the same problem. But there's no reason for that. And there are some interpretations in which that's not what a measurement is. I'm not going to go into details, but Carlo Rovelli's relational quantum mechanics is an example of that. In that theory, an individual electron can measure another electron just as well as a macroscopic measuring device. So it's not quite the same thing. They're the same only if you identify measurement with macroscopically distinct states, which, of course, most people do. So it's only a minor pet peeve. Okay, so the problem is that you've got two ways of dealing with measurements in quantum theory. We've got the measurement postulates. We can apply the Born rule. However, we expect that a measurement device is just another physical system. It's made out of atoms and so forth. So it should have a quantum mechanical description. So we should be able to describe a measurement as a unitary interaction between the system we're measuring and the measuring device. Okay? Okay, so let's consider an example. Suppose you have a qubit, which is in a superposition of state 0 and 1. And we're going to perform a projective measurement of whether it's in the zero state or the one state. So if we apply the measurement postulates, it says that we'll get zero with this probability, one with this probability, And if it's non-destructive, the state will collapse to either 0 or 1. So that's one way of doing it. The other way is to try and model the measurement device as a physical system. So let's suppose that this is a physical system, and let's let this state R be the state in which the system is ready to perform the measurement. Okay, so we'll have our initial superposition of our qubit, and we'll have the measurement device in its ready state. Okay, so then if this is a physical interaction, it's going to be described by a unitary operator. Okay, so let's suppose that M0 is the state in which the measuring device registers outcome 0, and M1 is the quantum state in which it's registered an outcome M1. It could correspond to, for instance, if the measuring device has a pointer, it could be the pointers over here or the pointers over there. Now, if this measurement device is going to be accurate, we expect that if you were to input the state 0, you should, the measurement device should always end up in the state M0. It doesn't actually matter whether this ends up in the state, this stays in the state 0 or not. That's one way of doing it. You could have some non-trivial thing happen to the system afterwards. But just for simplicity, I'm not doing that. Similarly, if you were to input the state 1, then you would expect the measurement device to register 1. That's what we mean by it being an accurate measurement. But now, if I input the superposition, because the unitary operator is linear, I'm going to end up in a superposition of two distinct states. Okay, so that's what the unitary treatment says will happen. So if you believe the orthodox interpretation, that's physically distinct from either of these possibilities. Okay. The physical properties that the system has in here and here are just different. Yeah?
We just said that we have unitary evolution when there is no measurement, but now we're also talking about unitary.
Yeah, but the point is that there's no definition of what's a measurement. The point is that if you think that your measurement device is just another system, physical system, it's made out of atoms, it's... I should be able to describe it. In principle, I can describe it quantum mechanically. So I can step back and take a view in which I'm treating both my system and my measurement device as quantum physical systems.
Yeah, but then measurement happens. Is the same as no measurement. You just have two systems with unitary evolutions, and then what's the difference?
Well, the point is that I can do these two descriptions, right? And the point is that they lead to different states. Right, so if you believe the orthodox interpretation, you can't have a situation in which you can assign two different states to the same system because the state is the unique physical property of the system. Right, so that's what's sort of being pointed out here as a contradiction. Yeah?
You say that it leads to two different states, but you're just describing different systems.
I'm describing the same. So in quantum theory, I have two sets of postulates. I have the postulates for quantum dynamics, and I have the postulates for quantum measurement, right? And what I'm saying is, there are situations in which I ought to be able to apply one or the other description of the same physical system, right? If we think there's nothing special about a measurement, it's just another physical interaction, I ought to be able to describe it unitarily.
Yeah, so you get
But by definition, if it's a measurement, I ought to be able to apply the measurement postulates as well. Right? So the fact is that those two prescriptions lead to different results.
What do you mean by different results? You have two different things. One is a wave function on the Hilbert space of both systems. And one is a probability distribution on one system. If I trace out the second system, I get the same thing.
Well, you don't get exactly the same thing. What you get is a density matrix that's a mixture of these two things.
Which is indistinguishable.
Yes, but if you're talking about a realist account like the orthodox interpretation, it says there's something which is like the true pure state of everything. And those are distinct here.
So you're making a distinction between two things which are, like, it's physically impossible to ever observe a difference between the two.
Well, that's a bit of a shaky issue, because that's again something that's going to come up towards the end of the course, because you can imagine, if you've done a measurement coherently like this, you can, in principle, undo this unitary evolution. But if you think this has really happened, if you think that there's really been a collapse, then you couldn't do that. Right, so in principle, I could apply the inverse of the unitary that generated this and get back to my initial superposition. But that wouldn't happen here if this has really happened. So if collapse is like a real physical thing that actually happens, then those two things aren't quite physically the same. Of course, for all practical purposes, for all everyday practical purposes that we can actually do in the lab, you're right, they are. Anyway, but the point is, the orthodox interpretation says that you know, systems have properties. That property is basically the pure state of the system. So if you have a situation in which you've got two different descriptions like this, that's just different physical properties. Yeah.
Is it fair to say that the orthodox interpretation predicts that the top line should happen, but what we observe physically is the bottom line? And that's
the orthodox interpretation includes both unitary dynamics and the measurement postulates. What I'm pointing out here is that the orthodox interpretation is contradictory. It contains two ways of modeling the same physical phenomena that give different answers. So that's just a contradiction.
It's a failed consistency check.
Yeah, the interpretation isn't consistent. I mean, the interpretation is kind of obviously wrong, right? That can't be it. Don't worry, though. I mean, this isn't the Copenhagen interpretation. The Copenhagen interpretation is much more anti-realist than that, right? So it doesn't mean... It means that what you read in your textbooks is maybe obviously wrong. Doesn't necessarily mean that Niels Bohr and company were wrong. That's a much more subtle issue. I'm not anywhere near as far as I expected to be. So let's see. We may have to conclude soon. Okay, so what I want to say is that the measurement problem here is a problem for psi-complete theories like the orthodox interpretation. It has been solved in every coherent interpretation on the market, right? So if you have an interpretation that's psiontic but not psi-complete, something like de Broglie-Bohm theory, which says there are particle trajectories in addition to the wave function, then the additional variables may determine which of these two things are the relevant branch, the one that you actually see in the laboratory. And then you can interpret this stuff, the measurement postulates, as just some mathematical shorthand that is, you know, equivalently going to predict what you see, and it's just the same as this, but we stop bothering to track the second branch, which doesn't correspond to where the particles are. You don't need to, because it's never going to be relevant to the dynamics again. So on that view, you'd view this kind of thing as just a convenient mathematical shorthand. This is what really happens, and the additional particle properties are determining which of these two things really happens. In a psi epistemic theory, the measurement postulates might just be viewed as somehow no different from updating a probability distribution on the acquisition of new information. In that case, in the Schrodinger's cat case, you might say, look, this macroscopic superposition of a dead cat or an alive cat or a Trump or Clinton presidency, those just somehow represent, you know, there really is one thing or the other that happened already, and I just don't know what it is yet. When I look, I update, just as you would with a probability distribution. Right? So when I flip a coin, don't show you the outcome, you assign probabilities a half. When I show you the outcome, then you change to either heads or tails. But there's nothing really mysterious about that. However, in a psi-complete theory, you really do have this kind of problem, where there's one unique psi. But even if, you know, even with these two cases, you know, you still have the problems that I pointed out last time. So I personally think that this is a better way of saying what the problem with quantum theory is than starting with the orthodox interpretation, pointing out problems in it. I'm just showing you this because this is the way it's traditionally done. It's past already, so should I Should I stop here or go on to the next thing?
Have you finished the section?
I finished the section on the measurement problem. Oh no, I got one more slide on the measurement problem. And I was going to talk about EPR and their cloning, but we could do that.
If we can get to the end of section 2 in 5 minutes, then yeah, but otherwise it's probably better to
Okay, so let me just do this one, and then yeah, I'm very over optimistic about the amount of material I can put in the lecture. Okay, so I also want to make a comment about the anti-realist theories, right? So if you're an anti-realist, say you're an operationalist, you can't state a problem like I've stated it. However, you still have in those approaches the idea that measurements are an undefined primitive, right? If you think that anything that exists are the outcomes of measurements, then the idea of a measurement, this is a measurement, that's just like put in by hand. What's a measurement? What's not a measurement? So there's no principle within such an approach that tells us when should you apply the measurement postulates and when should you apply unitary dynamics. You just have to accept that that's a primitive. And if different people make different choices, they say this is a measurement, this isn't a measurement, then they may end up disagreeing with one another. So in practice, as John Bell says, for all practical purposes, none of this really matters. In practice, there's very, very rarely a situation in which physicists disagree on whether to apply the measurement postulates or not. Sometimes there are subtle issues that come up and people have arguments about it in the literature. This happened like in the 1990s with something called the quantum Zeno effect, right? There are sometimes arguments about it. It is subtle. It's not always 100% clear. But for most purposes, it's kind of obvious what a measurement is, so you're never going to get into a difficulty. But if you're interested in fundamentals, if you have a fundamental theory that has measurement as an undefined primitive, doesn't tell you what a measurement is, that's arguably an incompleteness of the theory. You'd arguably like some better criteria. If you're an anti-realist like this, you may accept, for example, the decoherence account, which we'll talk about in later lectures. But you know, as it stands, there still seems to be a problem here. Okay, so I'll leave it there for today. Thanks.